Okay, so I guess we can start. Are you ready? Are you sure that's always a warning sign if I ask, are you ready? It means this is going to be scary Dhamma talk. I'm going to talk about tonight, I thought about relationships. Obviously it's going to have a Buddhist kind of angle. So, you know, it's always when it has a Buddhist kind of angle on these things, you know it's going to be challenging, right? That's kind of how things are usually. So I'm just giving you the opportunity to leave now before it gets too challenging for you. Huh? So I'm just joking mostly because the idea, of course, is really just about how to deal with relationships in a way that is skillful and that is wise, considering what the Buddha taught us about these issues and these kind of things. One of the strange things about relationships is that on the one hand, they bring us much joy in life. There's much happiness that comes from having a nice family, having a nice kind of romantic relationship, perhaps, having good friendships in life. All of these kind of relationships are often very meaningful for us. And when they are done well, they can be very powerful and very useful and very enriching for our lived experience. So these are very significant things in our life. One of the things that the Buddha always reminds us of is that there are also downsides to these things. And one of the critical things in life is to be able to balance the downside and the upside in such a way that we get the most out of these relationships. Because the downside of the relationship is that it has to end. It always has to end, regardless of how good that relationship, in fact, even more so when it is a really good one. That's when the end is often very painful. We have a really good family relationship. We live in harmony with our children and parents and whatever it is. You have a very good relationship. And that means, of course, that when it has to come to an end, it is very, very hard. Romantic relationships are often the most powerful ones that we have, where there's the most emotional involvement of all. And when they come to an end, they can be extremely painful and extremely difficult. We know what these things can be like. So there's always the relationships, especially the good ones, they have to end somehow at the end of the day. There comes a point when there's nothing more we can do, and we have to say goodbye. Someone has to die, someone has to depart. And this is the nature of relationships. So how can we deal with this in a skillful way so as to make relationships good ones? One way of having a relationship is to become a monk, right? Or a nun. That's a really skillful way. Is that right, Novimoka? Would you agree with that? But this is not going to be a kind of advertisement for monasticism. It's not really about that. It is about, this is only one option. The other option is also to learn how to live with relationships in a good way in your life. I should maybe add that the best kind of relationship in the world is the Kalyana Mitta. You know the word Kalyana Mitta? Very important word. You know this is great. And Kalyana Mitta means like the good spiritual friend. This is the most important relationship, like from the Buddhist point of view. And that means that the number one spiritual friend is Buddha. Wow, who said that? Someone very wise back then. Okay, Talata. It had to be you. Okay, excellent. The Buddha, number one spiritual friend. Number two spiritual friend are kind of all the, maybe perhaps the monastic community, the people who can teach you these teachings, hopefully through a little bit of personal experience and these kind of things. Then the broader Buddhist community, all these people who help you on the path, these are our spiritual friends. And at the end of the day, from a Buddhist point of view, this is kind of the highest kind of relationship. But that is not what the talk about is today. The talk today is more about the ordinary relationships and how to think about them in a skillful way. So to start this off, I'm going to talk about a story from the suttas. The suttas are the word of the Buddha, in case you haven't heard that already. So these are the teachings that the Buddha gave about 2,500 years ago, and lots of beautiful stories in the suttas. And sometimes you may hear some very dry teachings in Buddhism, but actually there's a lot of wet teachings as well. Sometimes they're so wet, you start becoming teary because the stories are so profound and so nice and so emotionally touching in many ways. And this particular story is found in a sutta called Sutta on That Which Is Born from Those Who Are Dear. Piya Jataka Sutta in the Pali language. I always say the Pali title because it sounds really impressive. And it kind of then you get kind of authority, people listen even more afterwards. That's kind of one of the tricks of the trade. I'm giving away all the tricks of the trade here. So, Piya Jataka Sutta, right? Born from those who are dear. And this is a very touching story. And it's a very ordinary story that everyone here will be able to relate to. And there's this man, and this is like this man who was living at the time of the Buddha, and he had lost his son. And because he had lost his son, he was absolutely distraught. He was grieving like crazy, basically. He was in a terrible, terrible state. And he was wandering around, kind of going to the cemetery every single day and saying, "My son, where are you? My son, where are you?" And of course, the son was gone, but he was going mad from grief because he had lost his only son. And because he was going so badly, so mad from grief, he couldn't eat his food. He couldn't do his work. All the ordinary things of life didn't have any meaning anymore because the one thing that mattered to him the most had disappeared in his life. "Where are you, my son? Where are you, my son?" This is what grief does to you, right? I'm sure all of you have had some experience of this because it's a part of the human condition. It is almost impossible to live through a life without any kind of grief whatsoever. And sometimes it can strike you in a very deep and a very powerful way, whereby you almost lose your senses, lose your mind. You go really confused and deluded, have no idea what's up and down and right and back anymore, left, right and left. I'm getting confused myself there, but whatever it is. And then he goes to the Buddha. Because he realized, well, there are people in this world who have an insight into things. This is one of those beautiful things about ancient India. If you had a problem, you go to some sort of ascetic, some sort of spiritual person who had some insight into the nature of life. And I wish that was more common also in the Western world. Actually, it's quite good here, right? See all the people coming here, it's wonderful. But it's actually a beautiful thing to do because sometimes with spiritual people, you get a different angle. I'm not saying we shouldn't use counselors and this kind of thing. These also have a very important a part to play in kind of mental health and getting us on the right track. But the spiritual path often has a deeper understanding of things, seeing more the underlying issues, and can therefore give you an answer that is more profound and more useful for yourself in the long term, that you can bring with you into your life, into the future, and can have a profound effect on your entire life, how you live, how you think, how you perceive the world around you, how you act, how you speak, everything basically. And so he goes to the Buddha. Good on him for going to the Buddha, right? He goes to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, he doesn't say anything, he just comes to the Buddha, he sits down. You don't know what it's like when you're grieving so much, you can't even talk, right? You sit down, you stare at the Buddha and you don't know what to do. And the Buddha says to him, he says, "Well, you look like you have lost your senses. Yeah, you look like a man who is deranged." And then he replies, "How could I not be deranged? I have lost my only son. I can't eat, I can't work, I can't do anything. I just keep going to the cemetery all day and saying, 'My only son, where are you?'" And then the Buddha replies, and this is kind of, this is what Buddhas are like maybe, but the Buddha says, that is the way it is. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arises from those who are dear. And that's kind of extraordinary. In one sense, it is so obvious when you see a situation like this. In another way, no one ever says that kind of thing. Have you ever heard anyone say that in your life? Yeah, watch out. Sorrow, lamentation, pain and grief arise from those who are dear. Nobody says that. Get into a relationship, have fun, enjoy yourself, get a family, have kids and all these kind of things. Yay, this is good. Actually, no, maybe not. There's another side to the story here. And so what happens? And what happens, of course, is that this man, he is not pleased, right? This is kind of the weird thing about humanity. He says, "What are you talking about, Master Gautama? That's nonsense. Yeah, joy and happiness arise from those who are dear." That's what he says to the Buddha. He's in denial, right? Here he is, he's grieving so much, he's almost ready to commit suicide, it seems. He's in a really kind of difficult way. But when the Buddha points out the problem, he can't see it. It's denial. It's too profound. It's too difficult to accept. And that's kind of extraordinary. And then then the story goes on. And then he goes off and he carries on and he kind of goes to the outskirt. This is one of those large monasteries in ancient India, in Savatthi, the Jeta Grove. And he goes to the outskirts and he kind of goes into the little maybe village or whatever. And he finds some gamblers. Yeah, gamblers are considered kind of low on the scale of the status hierarchy. Yeah, they're not the most important people in ancient India. So he comes to these gamblers. Dutta is the Pali word. It means like dodgy characters, basically. Kind of maybe that's a good translation, dodgy character. Okay, I'm not getting into translation now. But he comes to these dodgy characters and he tells them, yeah, I went to the Buddha and the Buddha said, you know, pain, grief and despair arises from this, from those who are dear. But I say, no, happiness and joy arises from those who are dear. What do you guys say, you gamblers? And say, yeah, you are right. Yeah, happiness and joy arises from those who are dear, said those gamblers. And of course, the distinction here is this kind of contrast, right, between the dodgy characters, yeah? They say the happiness arises from those who are dear. And the Buddha, yeah, who then says no, it is also the other way around. The contrast there is important because it points to where the profound truth actually is to be found. Yeah, the problem is all relationships must end in this way. And the better that relationship was, the more very often the grief is going to be when this whole thing comes to an end. So the question then is, how do we deal with this? How can we actually have our relationships in one way, at the same time avoid some of that grief, avoid some of that terrible consequences that comes from these attachments and these close connections that we have with other people? When we are really emotionally involved with someone, actually this is when these kind of things happen. I'm sure you know what it's like when you are very strongly emotionally involved with another person. Yeah, whether it is a family member or it is a romantic relationship or maybe even just a friendship. And what it is like when, you know, you kind of think about your children all the time. They're always in your mind because they are so important to you. Or when you fall in love with someone and they kind of occupy your mind, you can't get them out of your mind, yeah? They become part of you, merge together in this unit, yeah? You and the other person. And you know that when that happens, yeah? I'm sure everyone here has had these kind of experiences. You know when that happens. You can feel it. If you really feel what is going on there, there's also a great vulnerability in that situation. Because when you kind of fuse into one kind of unit like that, because you are so emotionally involved with the other person, if that other person leaves you, if they die, you know it's going to be extremely painful as a consequence. It is as if part of your psyche is getting pulled away from you, it's getting torn out, because there's a feeling of kind of being psychologically merged, and when a part of that psychological merge suddenly gets torn away, it's going to be very, very painful. And it's kind of very obvious when you are a monastic, because as a monastic, you cannot really get into these kind of relationships. But sometimes you can see like a tiny little spur, the very beginning of something, right? Because maybe there's someone that you find a little bit attractive, or maybe some family member that you still have some attachment to. And you can see that spur in your heart. And because you have the opportunity as a monastic to go back to your kuti, go back to be by yourself, you have enough room to reflect on these things, and then you can see the downside very clearly. You can see that vulnerability there, that danger which lies within that thing, and if you don't do something about it, it's going to have really, really bad effects in the future. So be aware of these things, right? Because when you are aware of these things, when you see the problem, well, then we can take some kind of countermeasure to ensure that actually the problem isn't as great as it would otherwise be. That is kind of the critical thing here. So this is the important point. So the Buddha talks about this in a few different ways. And he talks about, he gives some kind of beautiful similes about this that can be very kind of useful just to bring out very briefly. And one of the things that the Buddha talks about, he talks about the simile of the debt. Yeah, when we get involved in things in the world, when we get attached to things in the world, and this is much larger in a sense, you know, has to do with relationships, it can do have to do with attachment to anything really. When we get attached to something, we incur a debt. When we enjoy the world, the things, we incur a debt, and that debt has to be paid back at a certain point. And when it is paid back, like all debts, there's always an interest to be paid. There's no such thing as debt without interest. This is one of those beautiful little similes that the Buddha uses to kind of explain the problem with these issues. Another thing that the Buddha often talks about in the suttas, he says that everything and everyone that are dear and pleasing to us must become otherwise. Yeah, and this is one of the foundational reflections on the Buddha's path. The Buddha kind of gives five fundamental foundational reflections. One of them is that you must die, you have to get old, you are the owner of your karma. But one of them is the fact that everything dear and pleasing to us must become otherwise. Yeah, the same kind of idea. It's this reminder that there is a problem here. We should do something. We need to practice in the right way so as to minimize these kind of issues. So there are just a couple of ways of thinking about this. And as we do that, we start to kind of come a little bit to our senses. Another of the similes that the Buddha uses, which also kind of starts to point us in the right direction, of what we actually need to do to deal with these things. And this is the simile of the grass torch. Yeah, and the simile of the grass torch goes as follows. It is dark outside, you need some kind of torch to show you the way, so you light a grass torch. Grass torch, very useful when it's dark, you can see where you're going, you can see what's going on. So you pick up the grass torch. But if you pick up the grass torch in the wrong way, if you pick up the grass torch and you go against the wind, then of course, it being a grass torch, there are going to be embers coming off that. And because you go against the wind, all the embers are going to hit you. And before you know it, you're going to be ablaze, right? And being ablaze is not recommended by the Buddha, or by anyone for that matter. Yeah, it's not a very smart thing to do. When kind of your robes are going up and your kind of your hair is getting burnt off, and before you know it, you're dead, basically. That's not, if you're not an arahant, don't be dead. That's kind of one another thing the Buddha says. Wait with death until you are ready to die. So the idea here is that when we pick up things in the world, just like a grass torch, when we pick up our relationships, when we pick up things that we think we own and all of these kind of things, if you pick it up in the wrong way, it's going to burn you. It's going to hurt you in exactly the same way as that grass torch. So the idea then is that we had to pick it up in a different way. Don't pick it up and hold it against the wind. Hold it in a different direction, ideally with the wind. And when we hold it in a different direction, then that same thing that we pick up is going to be less of a problem as a consequence. So how can we do this? Now, one of the things that, occurs to me when I think about relationships is that very often when we have a relationship, let's say it is with a family member, a child in our family, or maybe our parents, or a favorite grandparent, or whatever it is, these relationships, why we are with those specific people is really random. Why did you get born into this family, not another one? What is the reason why we are with these particular people? And the reason is often very random. You get reborn into a certain family for all kinds of strange reasons. But it's not because necessarily you have a close or important relationship with them. And then you build up that emotional connection with them over time because you know each other intimately. And that intimate knowledge is really what that close emotional relationship is about. It's the same thing in the romantic relationship, right? The reason why we get really close to somebody is because we know them very intimately. We talk to them, we know about their past, we know how they act, we know about their life, how they live with us, and gradually you build up a very powerful bond between two people. But if you understand that this is really quite random who it is that you end up with, you could probably end up with a similar kind of bond with so many people in the world. Because what makes the bond is not the person, that they are special, that they are unique. Yes, I found the special love of my life, they are really different from everyone else. They're not, right? They are a person just like so many other people in the world. And the bond is created by the way we relate to them, the way we talk to them, the way we kind of create an intimacy with this particular person. But it could have been so many other people. The same thing with our kids, with our parents, whatever, whoever else it is in the world. There is nothing really special about these people. And once you start to see that, you start to see that actually, maybe this relationship itself actually isn't really what I think it is. It is a creation of the mind. It is a fantasy. It is an imagination that is built up because of, well, just how things kind of turned out to be. I happen to know this person and not someone else. And you can start to see here what the answer then, the solution to the problem is. And the problem is that instead of focusing our love, our attention, our care, our kindness on one person, we start to universalize what is going on, and we start to understand that actually this love, a more pure form of love, is something that so many people in the world actually are worthy of, because they are similar to my partner, they are similar to my child, they are similar to my family members. And then you start to broaden out your mind, and you bring more people into the field, and that starts to become very beautiful when you start to do that, because the limits of the mind that limit you to one person or another person, they start to be broken down. There is another way of thinking about this, and this is a way that you also find in the suttas, the word of the Buddha again. And there's this powerful suttas where the Buddha says that if you look around the world and you look at all the people around you, you can be almost sure that almost everyone in the world, almost everyone you meet, have at one point been your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, your daughter, or your son, in some kind of family relationship with you. Yeah, everyone here has been in a family relationship with you. Can you feel that? What does that mean? Well, what it means is that instead of seeing your son or your daughter or your parents as special, you start to see everyone as special in a certain way. Right? You broaden out your heart to include everyone. If Nicholas was my... You're already my brother in this life, but you're probably a brother in my past life as well. Or maybe I was your sister or whatever. I don't know what was the truth. But if everyone here were brother and sisters, sons and daughters, parents or whatever in the past, you start to look at people in a very different way. Remember that beautiful sentence that you find in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, one of the most beloved of all the suttas of the Buddha, where the Buddha says that you should love everyone as a mother loves her only child. Because a mother's, or maybe a father as well, but certainly probably maybe mothers a bit more, the way they love their child is that there is no limit to the compassion. There's no limit to the forgiveness. We always forgive. We see weaknesses because a mother has seen this child growing up and knows all the innocent sides of that child, knows all the beautiful sides. She can always forgive the child. In the same way, when we look at other people, we should look for those positive things. We should look for the beauty in them. And in a Buddhist society like this, there's a lot of really positive things going on. It's easy to see the goodness in the people around you. So everyone here is like your brother and sister. Everyone here is like your child, your daughter and son. When you start to think like that, you start to open up your heart. You start to see the world in a very different way. And that becomes very powerful and beautiful. And you can actually start to see how things really start to change when you do that. So this is the beginning of how we overcome this problem. You can start to get this idea that there is a real solution here going on behind the curtain, behind the darkness, behind the problems that might be there. And how can we take that further? And the way to take it further, the way to understand how this Dhamma actually works, that is to develop the idea of metta and compassion, develop the idea of loving kindness, which is metta, friendliness, goodwill to other people, systematically develop that in your life. And as you develop that thing in your life, you find that your need, you start to feel fulfilled from within. That need that we had before for other people in our life to fill that gap within, I remember many years ago, we had this Kalyanamitta group here at the Buddhist Society. Now it's called the KFC. I don't know, I thought Kalyanamitta was a better name, but anyway, now it's called KFC group. And this Kalyanamitta group, at a certain point, there were lots of young people coming to this group. And I remember there was this young woman, I have no idea how old she was, maybe around 20 or something. And she said that, you know, I need to be in relationships all the time because I don't feel complete unless I am in a relationship. And I can't remember what I said to that, but I kind of, the alarm bells went off, right? Talk about making yourself vulnerable. If you really need to be in a relationship to be complete, you're always going to be very vulnerable to that relationship breaking up. And so I wanted to, what I should have said, of course, is that there is another way to feel complete. You don't have to have a relationship to feel complete. What is that other way? Well, that other way is to practice metta, practice kindness, practice friendliness, practice goodwill, practice loving kindness and compassion. These things, when you practice them fully, make you feel complete inside. In exactly the same way, actually in a far better way than relationships do it. And you feel complete, you feel like you don't need anything else because the holes within, all those gaps, all the neediness that you may have is all deleted from the mind when you have a lot of kindness for the entire world. And it's one of those very strange things. I don't know what you think. Maybe you think that monks and nuns are very lonely people. Is that what you think? You think we're really lonely? It sounds lonely, right? We live in this little hut in the forest somewhere, far away. We don't see anyone. I mean, I don't see anyone 22, 23 hours a day. I don't see anyone, except when I come here. I see a few people when I come here, of course, but don't really see anyone. But the thing is, very few monastics feel lonely. Maybe occasionally you might feel a little bit lonely because you're having a bad day, I don't know, but it's very, very rare, right? It doesn't really happen, even though you spend all that time alone. And there's a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is because as a monastic, you are kind of supposed to be solitary, yeah? So it doesn't feel strange. If you live in the city, it kind of feels strange to be by yourself all the time because everyone else, maybe, actually probably isn't true even, you think that everyone else is hanging out with somebody, but actually they're not, they're also kind of a bit lonely perhaps. But as a monastic, you are first of all supposed to be by yourself, and that kind of helps. But the other thing, if you live well as a monastic, if you have that kindness in your heart, if you have that well-wishing for the whole world, you feel complete as you are. You don't need that socializing. Yeah, you feel that your heart is full. You don't need anything external. In fact, it's often the other way around. It is when you meet people, that's when you feel that you need something more, right? Because when you meet people, it can stir up all kinds of things. But when you're in your kuti, actually, it's not that hard to be content. And this then is the idea for everyone, all of us. If you want to reduce your vulnerability in life, develop metta. Develop loving kindness, develop compassion, develop more understanding for the people around you, live with more goodwill to the world around you. And as you do that, your heart starts to fill up. You start to feel complete within. You become less vulnerable to the breakdown in relationships and all of these kind of things. But the additional benefit, and this is what is the real paradox, not only do you become less vulnerable, but you become better at relationships. Because you have less vested interest. You can see things more clearly. You understand how those relationships actually work in the right way. Instead of trying to manipulate the other person because you are attached to them, you are more cool. And you can see what really is for the long-term benefit of that relationship. So it has kind of both sides to it. And then when that relationship eventually has to break down, you don't grieve so much because you have an independence in your heart. You have an ability to live for yourself, live by yourself, and then you can carry on in a good way rather than dying just after your partner dies. You know what it is like with old people, yeah? Old couples who have been together for 30, 40, 50 years. One of them dies, and not so long afterwards, the other person dies as well. Because their whole life revolves around their partner. They are like become one unit. And when half the unit kind of falls off, the rest of the unit doesn't really see the purpose of life anymore, and then they die too. And of course, that is unfortunate. We shouldn't really have that kind of profound attachments to each other. So develop the loving kindness in your life. So how to do that? I'm just going to very briefly remind you how to do that, because this reminders of how to live well and live in the right way is always very useful. And sometimes we may think that the idea of loving kindness is very profound. Yeah, you sit down, you close your eyes, and you say, "May all beings be happy and well." And it radiates kindness to the whole universe. That's kind of the idea, but it's not so easy to do, right? And people say, "Oh, I try this loving kindness. Is it all about fake it till you make it? Is that how it works? Or what is the story with this loving kindness stuff? That doesn't work for me. Yeah, I can't." So forget about that for a while. Very few people are able to really radiate loving kindness to the whole world in that way. It takes a very developed mind. In fact, it takes samadhi, really, before you can do that. In the meantime, start with the simple things. Yeah, and one of the things that the Buddha always talks about, or not always, occasionally talks about, is we start with loving kindness in just the way we act towards the people around us. Act with kindness to other people. Act with a sense of care. Act with a sense of goodwill to everyone around you. And as you do that, that is where this idea of kindness towards others, friendliness, of love to other people actually starts. And you will be surprised how transforming it is just to act with kindness towards others. Because the only way that you are going to be able to consistently be kind to other people in the way you act is often by changing your perceptions of other people. Sometimes your ego is going to say, "No, I don't want to be kind to this person." Has it happened to you? The ego says, "This person, okay, that person, okay, but this person, no way I'm going to be kind to this person. They have hurt me in the past, they are difficult, they talk in a bad way, no chance." That is the challenge, right? Right there is your challenge, because there should be no one you should not be kind to. You should be kind to everyone. And so by being consistently kind in the way you act to everyone, you actually have to change your psyche. Psychologically, you have to turn around. And that, of course, is the benefit of doing this. And then you speak to people consistently with kindness, with gentleness, with a sense of creating harmony in the world, in a sense that actually is meaningful and purposeful in life. Yeah, and that too is very difficult to do if you want to do it consistently all the time. And in this way, you build up your kindness stage by stage, building up the metta, the love inside of you, your understanding of the world around you. The next stage is then to start thinking about other people with kindness, consistently, with friendliness, seeing their good sides. Coming to the Buddha society, very few people in the Buddha society are perfect. Usually at this point I ask how many arahants there are here. And arahants mean like perfectly enlightened, right? And usually not so many hands go up, which is good. You're right. At least we are realistic about what is going on there. But so we learn to look at these people who are not perfect. We learn to see their good sides. We learn to see that there is a lot of good intentions here. People want to do the right thing, and that is worthy of enormous amounts of respect. The fact that someone is leaning towards the spiritual path and living in a good way, that is really worthy of respect. And that is really sufficient for them to deserve to be thought about in a good way. And then you learn how to think about people in the right way. You learn to forgive people's weaknesses. Why do people do bad things in the world? It's because very often they are driven by all of these habits, driven by all of these demons inside of them, driven by the darkness, driven by the delusion, not really understanding what is going on. And when you see that people are driven by these habits, they cannot change. They probably want to be kind. It is my firm belief that everyone wants to be kind, because we know that kindness equates to happiness. When I am kind to somebody, I feel good about myself. When I'm nasty to somebody, have I ever been nasty to you? I hope not, but if I'm nasty to somebody, I feel bad about myself, and I think everyone is like that. We want to be kind, but sometimes we just can't do it, and the reason we can't do it is because the conditioning is so powerful. And so you learn in that way to have compassion for these people who are driven by this program written a long time in the past, driven forward in negative ways. And then when you have compassion and loving kindness for everyone, and no one is excluded from that. That is when this kind of idea of metta is really starting to fill your mind. And that is when you start to feel really complete. And then you can start to do the meditation practice. Then you can sit down and you can start to spread that metta to the world around you, to the four directions, to all beings, wherever they might be. And then you start to feel something inside. And this is the gradual path towards becoming more and more independent as you live your life in this way. There's one last point that maybe I should also kind of point out. I did touch on it a little bit, but the flip side of being attached to somebody, the flip side of being really emotionally involved with someone, is being lonely. When you are lonely, there is a feel that you are not connected to the world around you, a feel that somehow you are isolated from everything around you. And that too has exactly the same, is caused by exactly the same problem. It's exactly the same problem really as attachment. This is the flip side of that problem. And because it is a flip side of that problem, it has the same solution. So by developing loving kindness, you're overcoming two fundamental problems in human life. Loneliness on the one hand, and the problem of attachment and deep emotional involvement on the other. Both of these are tackled by developing more metta. And all you have to do is to be more friendly, more kind, and more caring in your life. And as you do that, gradually you emerge. You become a more whole and more complete being. You start to feel this powerful sense of independence inside. And then you become, of course, far more wonderful as a person. You become a beacon of light for everyone else. When they see you living in this way, they know that here is someone who really has understood the path of Buddhism. So there you are. A little bit of a talk for you on the idea of relationships and how to deal with them in a skillful way from a Buddhist point of view. Okay, any monks and nuns? Anyone wants to become monk and nuns after this? Or have I? It's always a test of how good your talk was if kind of people start lining up and they're ready to become monks and nuns, but it doesn't usually happen. Thank you, Mr. Conrad. Are there any questions here in the hall before we go online? Anyone want to say anything here? Now this, you know, this is kind of a rare opportunity, you know? Every Friday night you have a chance to. Okay, Dan. Yeah, can we have a microphone over here, please? Bill, just over the second row there.
I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about the relationship that we have with our teachers and attachment to them, especially in how that makes us vulnerable to their own fallibility.
Okay. So relationship without... That's actually a very important relationship, right? That's pretty obvious. I think one of the important things when it comes to teachers is to choose your teacher wisely. You start off by choosing the Buddha, hopefully. I would recommend the Buddha. He's number one teacher. And the good thing about the Buddha is that you don't really get attached to the Buddha in the same way as you get attached to a living teacher, right? You see the Buddha lived at Savatthi, there was 500 monks present, and they gave a teaching to Devadatta or whatever it was. And you think, yeah, that's a nice story, but you don't have that attachment to the Buddha. And that is one of the advantages of having the Buddha as your teacher, precisely that it doesn't give rise to that attachment. You have a kind of a distance, and you have a feeling of coolness about it. But when it comes to living teachers, one of the things that you should be on the lookout for is manipulative actions on part of the teacher. Because if you get attached to a teacher, they will have a certain power over you, right? Now, one of the things that I realized when I came to Bodhinyana Monastery, which I really appreciated, is that I recognized that Ajahn Brahm, I in the early years, I kind of got a bit attached to Ajahn Brahm. I'm not attached to him anymore. I don't think so. No, that's kind of in the past. Sometimes you have to kind of, if Ajahn Brahm died, how would I feel? I would not be happy because it put a lot of burden on my shoulders. But is it because I'm attached to Ajahn Brahm? not entirely sure. But I do recognize that in the early years, yeah, there was some attachment there. And it was like you wanted to be noticed by Ajahn Brahm, yeah? Notice me, I'm here, for goodness sake. I'm asking a question, answer. Yeah, this kind of stuff. But what I really liked about Ajahn Brahm is he doesn't really allow you. He didn't allow you to become attached. Yeah, as soon as he felt that there was something going on which wasn't right, he wouldn't talk to you. He would kind of look away. He would walk off, right? It was like, and you had to look at yourself. What is going on here? I am the one who has the problem. I have to resolve this issue. And that is actually very powerful. So instead of him manipulating you, instead of him kind of taking advantage of that situation in some way, he does the exact opposite. He turns your attention onto yourself. You can see your own defilements. That actually was very, very powerful and very, very useful. So that is, I think, a good teacher should do that instead of kind of encouraging attachments, which actually are very detrimental and very, very bad for you. At the end of the day, it is like all attachments. Yeah, it's the same kind of way of dealing with it. It's understanding that it's going to end in tears if you get attached. Yeah, and that's just the way it is. It's always going to be the same, regardless of who it is. A classic example is, you know, at the funeral of the Buddha. At the funeral of the Buddha, you had all these monks and lay people coming there, and many of them were crying, yeah, and they were kind of, oh no, and it's a beautiful how this is described in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Yeah, they were wailing and crying and they're rolling around on the ground and holding their tummies as they were rolling around because the grief was so powerful. And you can imagine if the Buddha dies, it kind of makes sense, right? Because the Buddha was obviously a very, very, very towering figure in that Buddhist community. Yeah. And then there were the noble ones who says, well, you know, why are you guys crying? Yeah, what do you expect? All phenomena are impermanent. End of story. Yeah. That's the story. All phenomena are impermanent. That's what we have to remember. Yeah. And if you take that on board properly, and then you go back to your kuti, go back to your room, and you then deal with that attachment somehow, that is really what you have to do. And at the same time, fill yourself up. Maybe sometimes take a holiday from the monastery, go somewhere else to check out what's going on, and gradually you overcome those things. But don't give up easily. Carry on, carry on, carry on. One of the most important things that I have kind of found in my own monastic life is whenever I have a problem, whenever I'm stuck somewhere, don't stop, don't leave. Now is the time to deal with it. Now there's a learning possibility right here. Take that learning possibility and you're going to grow as a consequence. Anyway, just a few pointers. Anyone else here would like to ask something? Yes, please, over here. Can we have the microphone, please? Bill, front row over here, please. Second person here. Oh, over here first. Okay, sorry. Yeah, please. Please, please.
Yeah, I would like to ask, when you were mentioning that, story about the fire, to holding it not with wind, but, yeah. Sorry. Not against the wind, but with the wind.
Yeah.
I just got a thought in my, mind. It reminded me those monks who make suicide by burning themselves. Uh-huh. So I would like to know your thoughts on this.
It's a bad idea. It is a bad idea because the problem is that those monks, they are really... It's like they're into politics, really, right? Because they are making political statements by burning themselves up. And that is not what the spiritual path is about. As a monastic, your job as a monastic is to practice the spiritual life and not really to get involved in politics. So they're using this idea of burning yourself up to make a political statement. Sometimes you have to take your occupation seriously. Our occupation is to practice the spiritual life. Our purpose is to be kind of a little bit perhaps beacons of hope in the world, that there is an alternative way of living that can give rise to real contentment despite all the problems in the world. If you try to burn yourself up because you want to resolve worldly problems, there's no end to worldly problems. You're going to have to burn yourself up a million lifetimes in a row and the problems will still be there. What's the point? Instead, come back. The whole purpose of the Buddhist path is to understand that the world is always going to be problematic. Regardless of how many people burn themselves up, it's not going to solve all those issues. Find the real solution. The real solution is found in meditation, in wisdom, in understanding. That is where the solution is found. That is where those monks should practice. That's what I say. Okay.
I was just wondering about in going about in the world having love and compassion and kindness with everyone, do you think that then develops into self-love? Because we feel like we're having a relationship with ourselves and we are enough?
Absolutely, absolutely, it does. And I think one of the interesting things about human psychology is that if you have love in your heart for other people, it will go to you as well, because we can't really separate ourselves. If we have a general idea of seeing the goodness in other people, that attitude of seeing goodness will also see the goodness in ourselves at the same time. So sometimes in Buddhism, we talk about having self-love and kind of developing metta towards ourselves, you know, may I be happy and well. And sometimes that works, but just as powerful is actually to develop metta for others. And then the self-love happens as a consequence of that development for other people. So indeed, it's a very, I think, very important point to actually mention. So absolutely. Good. Okay, there's a couple of more questions. Maybe can we let Eddie, a few other people get a chance first of all. Yeah, few other people, Bill, first of all, and Eddie can come afterwards. Yeah. Eddie has had so many chances already, so yeah.
I just want to ask why, you know, there are four pillars of metta is one.
Yeah.
Why we always talk only about metta mainly and not about karuna or the mudita or equanimity,
yeah,
and how that relates to being loving, kind, and friendly.
Yeah, so there are four Brahma Viharas, four divine abidings, and how do they relate to this idea of being kind and things? And one of the things about metta is that it is by far the most common of the four Brahma Viharas. If you read the suttas and you see kind of suttas on the four, you find that mudita is hardly mentioned at all anywhere as a Brahma Vihara. Karuna is mentioned fairly often. That's the second most important one. But the most frequently mentioned one is actually metta practice. I think the reason for that is because it is the easiest one and the safest one. Very often you hear people talking about developing karuna, developing compassion. Compassion can have a downside, because compassion is like wishing someone freedom from suffering. That's what compassion really is. Yeah, I wish you freedom. And that wish in itself is very beautiful. But when we focus on suffering, it can very easily turn into a kind of sadness. Yeah, the sadness about the world people having so many problems in the world and all the wars and all these kind of things. So compassion is a little bit more tricky to get right. And if you get it the wrong way, then it's going to sap all your energy, because seeing all the suffering in the world is actually quite painful for every one of us. But metta doesn't have that downside, because metta is about seeing the positive qualities in human beings. Yeah, and so it doesn't have a downside in the same way. Upekkha is the highest of all these Brahma Viharas, so it's a very, very profound state. For that reason, we don't talk all that much about it. But, you know, when you get to the fourth jhana, come back and ask the question again, and we'll see what happens. I'm being naughty. I apologize for that. But would you have one over here, Bill, in the front row?
Hi there. Thanks so much for your talk. I get told, like, I practice exactly what you've been sharing this evening. I have been doing for many, many years. But people tell me it's a weakness, and I seem to annoy people with it. And sometimes they get angered by the positive vibe or the positive teachings that I try and, you know, live. Yeah. they say that I'm too nice. What do I do with that? Do I stop? But it's my Buddha nature to live my life as I am. But some people just seem to reject that, you know. So they're like, can't win.
People are stupid, isn't that? That's kind of the people are deluded. So I think it's good to, I mean, the idea with metta is also to kind of to help people. So sometimes you have to feel, kind of be sensitive to the situation and feel what works. The most important thing is to have metta within, so that you have those emotions. That's the most important thing. You don't always have to actually express it outside. Just feel the situation, know when it's going to be, have a positive effect on the people around you. And if you think it's going to be rejected, well then, it can be painful for you as well when that happens, yeah? So then just, okay, stand back. This person, I know they are a bit difficult, so don't kind of try too hard with this person. And then when the time is right and you feel that now is a good time to do it again, then you do it again down the track, yeah? But the most important thing is the emotion inside. And if you have the emotion inside, well, then you, at least, you will be fine because of that. So, yes.
Ajahn Brahmali.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Buddha said attachment is the attachment that brings the suffering. You know? Attachment, you're too close, you know, attached, you know. Mm-hmm. So, also, there are different types of relationships too, okay? Mm. So, can we use that the word, the attachment, be mindful of attachment. So, whenever in a relationship, if we have any problem, you know, that's my... Just be aware, oh, I'm too attached. That's why I have this problem. Mm. If I'm not so attached, maybe the problem is less. You know, like, so when there's problem, you work on this, and then you become to, from your tongue, you know, you become to sort of make it less, how do you say, make it more, less problem, you know, okay? Also, the Buddha did mention about a happy married life in the suttas, I remembered.
Sure, yeah.
What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah, just be aware that, oh, I'm too attached, you know.
Okay,
you see what I mean?
I see what you mean, yeah. I gave the microphone to Bill, otherwise you're going to talk more when I start answering. So I'm being naughty at this. So the answer is that, yes, it is very useful to know the problems of attachment. Yeah, it's very useful because that gives you the motivation to do something about it. But it's not enough because you need some kind of... island, you need some kind of independence, you need something which you can fall back on when you don't have that person anymore, when you are withdrawing a little bit or you are kind of becoming less attached. That can only happen if you build up strength inside, and that strength inside is built up through the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, through the kindness, through the care, through all of these kind of positive things that we develop. So this is why that is so powerful, because it is not enough to see the problem. You also have to have the resources to deal with it. And those resources are your internal psychological qualities that enables you to be more independent in the world. Do you understand?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Very excellent. Nice doing business with you, Eddie. So, okay. All right. So we have a few questions from outside. And the first one here is from Loria Wong, I believe. And the question is, I once heard that enlightenment has nothing to do with personality, which means that if you are introverted, you will be an introverted arahant. Is it possible to be a grumpy arahant? Yes, it is true. It is kind of said that you will retain many of your personal characteristics, yeah? So if you're like me, you're born in Norway, even if I were to become an arahant, I'd probably still eat salmon, right? Because that's kind of what Norwegians do. We are born and brought up with salmon. We don't know what else to eat. We'd probably starve if we didn't have a salmon. So we have a problem. And I'm exaggerating. So there's some truth to that, yeah? Many of your personal characteristics will carry on, but many will also kind of disappear on the way, yeah? Because many of our personal characteristics have to do with defilements, they have to do with all kinds of things. And I suspect that the introverted arahant probably be less introverted after you become an arahant, depending on what... the cause for that introversion. Introversion can probably happen for many reasons, but let's say that you are, you know, if it's people who get bit depressed, they can become more isolated, can be maybe considered a kind of introversion, and that, of course, wouldn't exist anymore afterwards. So some of these things will fall away as you practice the spiritual path. Grumpy arahants, well, grumpiness is usually a sign of ill will, right? It's a sign of a little bit kind of, oh, you know, shut up or leave me alone or whatever, like that kind of stuff. And of course, the arahant doesn't have any ill will. And because so an arahant would normally not be considered grumpy at all. An arahant might be efficient. Maybe they need to get something done. Maybe you don't feel properly heard or something. That can possibly happen. But if they are grumpy, I would say that they're not an arahant, they are a dodgy arahant. Yeah, that's kind of my, that's what I would say. Yeah. So watch out for those dodgy arahants, otherwise you're going to be taken for a ride. Okay, next one is from Sachinta Herat. And the question is, in the ancient Buddhist text, is it mentioned as to how the Buddha was able to tell beings about their past lives as well as potential future ones? The Buddha does not really tell people a lot about their past lives. I'm just trying to think now, what if there are any kind of clear examples in the suttas where he talks about other people's past lives. He talks about his own past lives, that's for sure, and that is kind of one of the powers that you can gain through meditation practice and remembering your past lives. Remembering other people's past lives, are there any really obvious examples of that? Anyway, it is not common, yeah, anyway, for the Buddha to do that. And the reason why we tend to think that the Buddha would do these things is because of all the additional Buddhist literature. Yeah, the Buddhist literature is so vast. The core suttas, which are the word of the Buddha, is fairly small. It's only about 10,000 pages. Yeah, so fairly small collection, 10,000 pages. So, and then there's the other 100,000 pages, right, which is all the additional literature or whatever. And it is in that additional literature where usually you find that the Buddha was telling people about the past lives and future lives, you know, places like the Jataka stories, they're very famous, the Dhammapada Attakatha, and you have this, something called the Anagatavamsa, which is about the Buddhas of the future, and all of these kind of things. And these are texts that weren't really spoken by the Buddha. And very many of these texts, we don't know where they really came from. And many of them seem to have been stories that existed in ancient India, and they don't really have an author, nor are they particularly Buddhist. Some of these stories are anti-Buddhist, but they're still part of the Buddhist literature for some reason. Yeah, the moral of these stories is completely ridiculous from a Buddhist point of view. Like feeding your wife and children to a tiger or some that kind of stuff. And it's kind of really crazy, crazy things. So I would say that most of these stories are not part of the core Buddhist text, and that the Buddha normally does not actually talk about the past lives and future ones of other beings. Next question. Ram Divakar Sitaraman. I hope I got that right. Question, why can't I let go of some thoughts at all? I can't stop thinking about the person or just be with myself. Letting go of some mental images feels very hard. So the reason why you can't let go is very simple. It's because these things are important to you. That is why you keep thinking about them. There's two reasons why you think about things in meditation. One reason is because your meditation is not going well. You're not enjoying yourself and your mind is desperate to get distracted. It really is desperate at sometimes. And because it is desperate to get distracted, it will get distracted. And this is one of the reasons why it is important to be comfortable in your meditation practice. The more uncomfortable you are, the more likely you are to get distracted. There was a man who came to Jhana Grove. Have many of you been to Jhana Grove? Here? Yeah? Yay, excellent. If you have been there, time to come. Jhana Grove is our meditation center down in Serpentine. It's one of the best meditation centers in the world, if you ask me. I am just marginally biased, of course, but anyway. And there was this man, and he, at question time, he had this question. He's saying that, you know, I'm sitting in my meditation, and the longer I stay on this retreat, the more ridiculous my thoughts get. And he said, this morning when I was sitting in meditation, I was wondering whether I had hung my shirt up the right way on the clothesline. What is the most optimal way of hanging your shirt so it will dry the fastest possible? What is the kind of most, from a physical point of view, the most aerodynamic kind of position of the shirt? And I consider this for the 1 hour of meditation. And this is what happens, right? And this happens because your mind is desperate to find an outlet. So the first thing, therefore, if you want to have success and you want to overcome these hindrances in your meditation, is be comfortable, be at ease, enjoy your meditation. Don't meditate if you feel extremely angry, for example. Do something else. If you're angry, listen to some nice music, have a good cup of tea, give your wife a hug or something like that, right? And then maybe you can kind of cool down, and then you can kind of get ready for meditation or whatever it is. Don't meditate if you are extremely restless. Be a reasonably balanced state of mind before you sit down and you try to do a meditation practice. So then you will be reasonably at ease and you will be able to enjoy the meditation. The other thing, the reason why you go to these images is because they are interesting to you. And the reason that they are interesting you is because you think there's something important going on there. What do people think about in the meditation? They think about their family, they think about their partner, they think about their work, they think about the problems that they have. And once you start to see what you're thinking about, then you know also what the solution is. And the solution is actually very simple. It is very profound, but it's very simple. And that is to understand that these things, there is nothing in these things that will ultimately give you any real happiness or satisfaction. This is the world of the five senses. It is impermanent. It is problematic. It is always out of control. There is no solution in that realm. And because there is no solution there, there's no point in thinking about it. You know that famous story? A story, one of Ajahn Brahm's famous story, found in his book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. You know the story about no solution, no problem. This is the story about this British Prime Minister called Harold Macmillan, who was a Prime Minister in the UK back in the 1960s. That was just around my birth, time of my birth, so I can't remember much of that. But anyway, so he was a Prime Minister and he was interviewed on TV here. And this was while there was, I think, the Six-Day War or something going on in the Middle East. Nothing has changed in the Middle East. They were warring then, they're still warring now. And so he was asked, well, you know, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? It was like on TV. And straight off the cuff, he said, there is no problem in the Middle East. What do you mean there's no problem? They're bombing each other, they're blowing each other up. Everyone is dying. What do you mean there's no problem? There is no solution in the Middle East, so there is no problem. There's nothing to think about. If there's no solution, what is there to think about? And this is the reality with all the things that we think about in the world. There is no solution in that realm. There is no way you're going to resolve all the problems at work. There is no way you're going to resolve all the relationship problems. There's just one coming after the next one. That is not where we build the future. You don't build the future by resolving the problems in the five sense world. The way we build the future is by building up spiritual qualities right now. Because those spiritual qualities that you build up now, you will take them into the future. And when you take those into the future, they will be the source of that happiness, the source of resolving things in the future. Because you will have inner strength. You will have a way of dealing with the world and actually lifting yourself slightly above the world and all its problems. And once you get that, once you get this idea that there is nothing really to think about in that realm because there is no solution there is no future there of any interest. The real future that you're building up here and now in your meditation practice. Once you get that in a deep way, you're not going to think about it anymore. And you will enjoy your meditation far more as a consequence. All right. Next one. This is from Sitara Nandasena. Dear Ajahn from Sri Lanka, do we meet our spouse due to kamma or is it a chance? Is it necessary to put an effort to find a partner or will it just happen automatically? You might be asking the wrong person, but anyway, I'll... I'm not a specialist in kind of partners and how to do that. Is it due to past karma? It can be due to past habits, because sometimes we have habits, we have attachments to somebody, and because we have attachments to somebody, then the mind automatically gets drawn to them through the rebirth process, and then we kind of end up with a similar family again in the future. So make sure you love your family in this life because you might get reborn with them in the future again. Make sure you have really good relationship with everyone. So yes, there is a tendency, that is the usual understanding of Buddhism, there's a tendency to be reborn within the same family. Is it necessary to put in an effort to find a partner? Probably a little bit of effort if you want a partner. Probably good to put in a little bit of effort, at least to kind of check them out, you know, if you, I don't know, look at them and see, is this the right person for me or something like that. But there was an interesting video, kind of one of these YouTube videos, which I kind of came across by chance. And the name of the YouTube video was Why We Always Choose the Wrong Partner. It was kind of fascinating. It was this idea that, you know, the reason why we choose somebody is not because we are wise. It's not because we understand ourselves really well and we know what we need. No. The reason why we choose somebody often comes from very deep-seated emotions. And very often it's because they remind us of our mother or our father or something like that. And then we choose someone who has similar qualities, or if we didn't like our mother, maybe the exact opposite qualities, right? Whatever it might be. But we are often driven by these deep-seated things that we don't really understand. And so that we end up in relationships that we don't really, you know, probably may not be the best for us. So if you're going to look for a partner, look for the things that are really important in life. Yeah, the things that you know is going to lead to a happy relationship. Look for kindness. Look for someone who cares. Look for someone who is compatible with you in a spiritual sense. Yeah, someone who is living a Buddhist life similar to yours, so you have a similar kind of basic root interests in life, then I think you will be doing very well. There is one story in the suttas about a supremely happy couple called Nakula Pita, Nakula Mata. And they were so happy, they went to the Buddha and said, how can we ensure that we get reborn together as a couple in the future? Yeah, we are so happy. They were both stream enters, by the way. That certainly helps. And the Buddha said, well, if you want to be reborn in the future, you have to develop the same spiritual qualities. If you do that, then you might get reborn again in the future. So spiritual qualities is really what it comes down to. Will it happen automatically? It's a very interesting question. Because I don't know, I just look at my own life, and when I'm in the middle of things, it looks like you have all this agency here. It looks like, you know, I mean, I had a girlfriend, you know, long, long time ago before I was a monk, 35 years ago, whatever it is now. Anyways, long time ago. And at the time, it feels like you have agency. It feels like you're making a choice. But in retrospect, when I look back, it actually doesn't look like it is a choice. Yeah, it looks like it is kind of circumstances, and those things suddenly happen, and suddenly you find yourself in a relationship and you wonder, whoop, what happened? Okay, now I'm in a relationship. It's a bit like that sometimes. It's kind of weird. So is it automatic or is it not? Well, that's a very profound question. I'm not sure if we have time to go into all of that, but certainly I would recommend you to do something. Remember that in the end of the day, what is most important in life is your spiritual practice. That is what is going to change your life fundamentally for the better. So choose someone in your life who will help you to live a better life, to be a better person, and to go as far as you possibly can on the Buddhist path. That would be the right person to choose. Okay, that is all for tonight. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namami.